The legal limit for blood alcohol for driving is 0.08. If you have a blood alcohol level of 0.09 and you drive, you are 8 times more likely than a sober driver to have an accident. But if you distract yourself by texting while you drive, you increase your chances of having an accident, and you are now 23 times more likely to have an accident being distracted by texting. In other words, texting while driving is more dangerous than driving while drunk. Every year, distracted driving causes the death of more than 3,000 people in the United States. That's the equivalent of a Boeing 737 crashing and everyone on board dying every single month. The number one cause of death among teens is car accidents. Half of those car accidents are caused by distracted driving. The point is clear that when your life is on the line, distraction is fatal. When your life depends on it and you allow yourself to be distracted, the consequences can be deadly. The purpose of the book of Colossians, from which our brother read this morning, is to address distraction by the Colossians. The book of Colossians was written to believers being distracted. Some of the things that they were being distracted by were bad. Some of the things they were being distracted by were good. Some of the things they were being distracted by were neither good nor bad. But the problem was that none of the things that were distracting them were Jesus. Because what the Colossians needed was to have their focus fixed firmly on Jesus. But they didn't. And so Paul has to write the book of Colossians to restore their focus onto Jesus. I want to pause there and just tell you what we're doing this week so that you'll sort of know what's coming. And then we will continue in the book of Colossians. I understand that you have been in or currently are in the book of Hebrews. Wonderful book. So what we're going to do this week, we started in Bible class, and what I intend to do this week is to take the six main themes. We have six lessons. We're going to take the six main themes of the book of Hebrews, and we're going to devote a lesson to each theme. But we're not going to do it in Hebrews. We're going to take another passage somewhere else in the New Testament that addresses that theme, and we're going to turn there, and pretty much we're just going to camp out there. We're pretty much going to find a passage, and we're just going to stay there. We're just going to dig through it, because that's the best way to read and study the Bible. The best way to read and study the Bible is to get into a text, to determine its context, to be familiar with the book, and just stay in it, rather than sort of like making a cake, sort of pulling verses from here and there and everywhere else, and sort of end up making a recipe that makes you happy. Like sometimes we pull all these verses, and as somebody said, a proof text without a context is just a pretext. A lot of times what we do is we end up taking a bunch of verses and we put them together in a way that we like, but don't know anything about the context of where they came from. And so we're just going to get in a passage and we're just going to sort of dig through it. It would be great this week if you could bring a Bible, and you know, physical Bible is always to be preferred. If you do digital, that's fine, no problem there. But that you be sure that you have a Bible, maybe a notebook and a pen to jot some things down, because it's really going to be more Bible study than sermon. It's really going to be like if you and I just sat down at the kitchen table and opened up the Bible and said, what is this passage about? And let's just dig through it. That's pretty much what we're going to be doing. But then at the end of every lesson, I'm going to give you some very specific, very practical applications. Because this is where the magic really happens, is in the application of the Scripture that we read. If you don't know how to apply it, there's no reason for you to know it. It's amazing to me how they bury the directions for how to take medication on a bottle, an over-the-counter bottle, how they bury it in a bunch of print that I can't read. Have you ever noticed that? They've got information on every side effect, every ingredient, everything you can possibly imagine, and it's almost impossible to find the little bitty section that says, here's how you take it. And they've made it even worse. They started hiding it. Now you have to like peel a label off and search for it in there. But if you can't find the directions to apply it, then you might as well not have it. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to go to a passage, we're going to plow through it, and we're going to get to the end of it and say, so what? Here's how we apply it. As I mentioned this morning, it's going to start to sound familiar. There is no magic pill here. There's no secret formula. There's no secret at all about how we grow in the faith. It's not mysterious. It's not mystical. It's really simple. It's three things. And I work a lot with people on life in general, but on health a lot. And one of the things that I share with people is that there are three pillars to physical health. There are three main things that you've got to get right if you want to be healthy. Nutrition, which includes hydration, exercise, and sleep. It's no mystery, right? You got to eat right, you got to exercise, you got to get enough sleep. You do that, you're pretty well, you're set, pretty much. And the same thing is true spiritually. There are three pillars to spiritual health. Bible study, prayer, and church. All of them are essential. It's like a three-legged stool. If you take one out, you're going to fall. And the same thing is true spiritually. It's no mystery. It's not hard. It's Bible study, prayer, and church. And we'll talk a lot about that as we go along. Back to Colossians. The point of the book of Colossians is that the Colossians were not focusing on Jesus. So Paul writes Colossians to bring their focus back to Jesus, the pinnacle of that argument, the summit of the argument, the most impactful statement of that argument is Colossians 1, 15 to 20. This is one of the four main passages in the New Testament about the nature of Jesus. There are four passages in the New Testament. It's all about Jesus. But there are four passages in the New Testament that are absolutely essential for every believer to be locked in on. And they are Philippians 2, 5 to 11, Hebrews 1 and 2, John 1, 1 to 18, and Colossians 1, 15 to 20. It's essential that we be familiar with those passages. So right now, we're in Colossians 1, 15 to 18. Appreciate the brother reading it for us this morning and getting us started. I want you to notice what he says at the end of verse 18. I'm not going to bury the lead, but we're going to get it right out there at the front. Here's what he's saying to us. Colossians 1:18. Look at the end of the verse. What we need to know about Jesus so that, Colossians 1:18, so that he himself will come to have what? First place in what? In everything. What does everything mean? It means everything. It means that Jesus would come to have first place in your life, your money, your TV habits, your scrolling habits, your marriage, parenting, work, congregation, whatever you have in your life, that Jesus would be first. Now, in this passage, very handily, I love a three-point outline. And there are just so many of them in the New Testament. Preachers love a three-point outline. And there are so many of them, and there's one right here. In this passage, Paul is going to tell us that there are three reasons why Jesus should have first place. Tell you what they are, then we'll talk about them, then we'll be done. Number one, Jesus should have first place in your life because Jesus is God. He's God. Number two, Jesus should have first place in your life because of His relationship to creation. And number three, Jesus should have first place in your life because of His role in your salvation. Those three things were in the passage that was read to us just a little bit ago. Let's break those down for just a little bit. Notice what he says in verse 15. He says that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. Now, you might say, that seems a little unclear to me. It says He's the image of God, but, you know, if I have on my phone, if I have an image of my wife, that's not my wife, it's an image of my wife, it's not this. See, you might say, that's not convincing to me. That seems a little unclear that verse is saying that Jesus is God. Well, there are a lot of verses that are very clear. John chapter 1 and verse 1, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was what? With God, and the Word, we already got, somebody already got there, thank you. And the Word what? Was God. The Word was God. John chapter 20 and verse 28. When Jesus appeared to the apostles and Thomas was his Thomas, I'm not going to believe until I can touch the scars. And Jesus showed up and he didn't have to touch anything. He looked at Jesus and said, what? What did Thomas say? My Lord and my God. People say he was just saying like people say, oh my God. And he didn't talk that way. He didn't talk like that. When Thomas saw Jesus, he said, that's God. I know that's God now. Jesus is God. Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 8, He has said of the Son, your throne, O God. Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 6, a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and His name will be called Mighty God. There is no question, no question, that Jesus is God. None. And what that means to us is several things. It's a beautiful thing because God is a spirit. Can't see God. So Jesus, who's God, God the Son, Jesus became a man and He came to the earth and He made God visible to. Yeah, I bet you know somebody that you say to people, that boy right there is the spitting image of his daddy. I bet you know somebody like that. That girl is the spitting image. You've never seen her mother, but there's her mother. Right? That's what this is saying. That when you see Jesus, you're looking at God. Now that's important to us for a lot of reasons. Does three things for us. It helps us to understand God better. You know, in the Old Testament, God was up on a mountain. And then God moved off the mountain into a mobile home and He traveled around the wilderness with the people in the tabernacle. Then they built the house and put Him in a house in Jerusalem. But He was behind a what? He was behind a veil. They never could see Him. That's the old covenant. In the new covenant, Jesus said, I will become a man and I will go down there and live among them and then they can see God. It's important that we can now watch God in action. It's important because now God gets us. God gets us now because He's lived among us. You know, here in America, we don't like people other places telling us what to do. Like, we fought a war back in the 1700s because we said we don't like people in London telling us what to do. They don't get us. And then so we got our own country and we still say, I don't want people in D.C. They don't get Grayson County. They don't know what's going on in Litchfield. I don't want Washington. And we even say, and Frankfurt's not that far away, but we say, I don't want Frankfurt telling us what to do. I don't want Frankfurt. I want somebody here in Grayson County telling me what to do. Then I probably won't listen to them either, but at least it's better than D.C., for heaven's sake. But that's how we are in America. I don't want somebody somewhere. I want somebody local. I want to keep it right here. Well, Jesus left heaven and He said, let me come live with you for a while and then I'll be able to get you. I can understand you. Now I can really help you. And that's what He does because God became a man. And the final thing it tells us is that whatever you owe to God, you owe to Jesus. Whatever honor or worship or obedience you owe God, you owe Jesus because He is God. Not everybody believes that. A lot of people think that they're trying to exalt Jesus by saying, well, He's not God, but He's the highest created being. He's an angel. He's a prophet. He's a great social reformer. He was a great man. Those people are demoting Jesus because Jesus is God. And anything that we call Jesus less than God is a demotion. He's God. And we must honor Him as God. The second thing that Paul says, the reason that they need to focus on Jesus is because of His relationship to creation. So notice what he says. Look at verse 15. He says that Jesus is what? In verse 15, the first what? The firstborn of all creation. That doesn't mean that He is the first created thing. That's not what that means. Because He's not created. It means, so in the Bible, the word firstborn can mean two things. It can mean, shockingly, born first. It can mean that. But it can also mean elevated to the highest place. I'll give you a couple of verses on that. Exodus 4:22 and Psalm 89:27. Those two verses, Exodus 4:22 and Psalm 89:27, show that firstborn can mean elevated to the highest place. That's what it means here. That Jesus is over creation. Now, why is that true? Look at verse 16. Because, look at what it says. It says, all things were created, verse 16, by Him. By Him. When you read Genesis 1 and 2, you don't see Jesus there, but He's there. All things were created by Him. Look at the end of the verse. All things were created through Him. The Father was working through Him. And all things have been created for Him. Everything exists for Him. He is the purpose for everything. Now, notice verse 17. He is before all things. And notice, in Him, all things hold together. What does that mean? In Him, all things hold together. That means that when Jesus was done creating on Friday night, He didn't do what most people do. He didn't stop working and take Saturday off. That's what that means. It means that when Jesus was done creating on Friday, He continued to hold it together on Saturday and every other day since. Jesus is the reason the universe continues to function. Because in Him, all things hold together. Now, why is that significant for us? Why is it important for us to know that Jesus is the source of all creation? Here's one big reason. I love amusement parks. I love them. I grew up in E-Town and Louisville. I really don't claim Louisville, but I grew up in E-Town. I claim that one, Hardin County. And when you grow up in E-Town or Louisville, you, in the summers, once or twice every summer, you're going to go north to Ohio, and you're going to go where? Where are you going in Ohio? Kings Island, right? Every summer. Once or twice at least. I love an amusement park, right? Now, when you go to an amusement park, what are you hoping to be? Amused. Right? That's why it's called that. But when you get there, they got a bunch of rules. You ever notice that? When you show up, they got a bunch of rules posted and on every ride. And it's really buzzkill stuff like don't stand up while the car's moving. Keep your hands and feet inside the car. If you got a heart condition, you might ought to think twice before you ride the beast. Well, where's the fun in that? I go to an amusement park to be amused, not to have to follow a bunch of rules. But the people that built King's Island put a bunch of rules on it. Why did they do that? Because if you don't follow the rules, something bad's going to happen. You can stand up while the car is moving if you want to, but you're probably going to break your neck. You can stick your hands and feet out of the beast if you want to while it's moving, but you're probably going to break something. If you got a heart condition, you can ride the viper, the cobra, or whatever that thing was that went upside down. You remember that with the metal one? If you got a heart condition, you can ride that, but you may not be with us when the car gets back. I mean, but that's why they put those rules on there. Because they made it, they know how to be in it without getting hurt. Jesus made the world. And then he gave a bunch of rules. Why did he do that? Because he doesn't want you to have any fun. That's why he did that. When I was a kid, so my dad died when I was 7. I'm an only child. Be around me 5 minutes, you'll know that right away. My mother is here with us this week with my wife and my daughter and one of my sons. And my mother's here. And so it was just my mother and I after I was 7. And, you know, my mother had a very difficult job, right? She had to raise a boy all by herself. I was not good. I was bad. I was rough. I was rebellious. And I was convinced that my mother, for pure enjoyment, sat up every night after I went to bed and got a notebook and a pen and said, how can I make his life miserable tomorrow? What rules can I make that will absolutely make him unhappy and angry? Now, she did a great job at it. I'll give her that. She's skilled at it. But that is not at all what my mother was doing. My mother was putting rules on me. Why? To help me have a good life, to be happy, to be safe, and to stay out of trouble. And when I violated those rules, I ended up getting hurt. That's the way it is with Jesus. Jesus created the world, and then he said, hey, I know how that thing works. Let me tell you how to live in it and have the best possible life. And then what do? We say, I don't want any rules. I want to do it my way. And then we get hurt because we didn't listen. We need to listen because Jesus knows how to make it work. The final thing that Paul says is that Jesus has the ultimate role in our salvation. Listen, Jesus is not one option among many for the salvation of your soul. That's what the world says. The world says, don't tell me that your religion is better. Don't tell me that your religion is right. All of them are good. All of them are equally fine. All of them are basically the same thing. So you have Jesus. I'll take Buddha. He's got Allah. Somebody else has whatever, Hinduism or whatever, and it's all the same. Listen, Jesus is not just one option among many. Acts chapter 4 and verse 12, there is no other name given under heaven by which men must be saved. Jesus said in John 14 and in verse 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And then what did He say? No one comes to the Father except through me. Jesus is not an option. It is Jesus or it is absolutely nothing. And that's what Paul says in this passage. Jesus is the only one. You know, one thing I don't understand is the confusion about carbonated beverages. First of all, I don't understand the confusion about what to call them. So we got all these people, they got all these weird things they call a carbonated beverage. Soda. Pop. What else do people call them? I try to forget all of them because they're all horrible. But there's only one right answer here. Every carbonated beverage is Coke. It's all Coke. Somebody said, well, wait a minute. What about Mountain Dew? It's Coke. Well, wait, what about Ale 81? It's Coke. What about root beer? It's Coke. So, and I've got these weird friends. Most of them are from the North. I've got these weird friends. And they'll say, well, how do you, if you ask somebody what they want and you have several things, what do you say? How simple is that? You say, what kind of Coke y'all want? I want Mountain Dew. I want Pepsi. I want whatever. It's just not that hard. What kind of Coke do you want? I want Mountain Dew. Fine. It's easy. But within all of that, so when we talk about all the different kinds of Coke, now we have to ask the question, which is really the only real kind? Which is the only kind anybody should ever drink, right? Well, we all know it's Coke. Well, what kind? I mean, Coke, right? I was very pleased to see, we went last night to the ice cream place, Twin Rivers. Is that Twin Rivers? Is that what it is? Twin Lakes, Twin Peaks. I don't know, whatever that is. We went over there. Very pleased to see they had Coke. I'm assuming that sends a message that this is Coke country, right? That everybody gets it around here. I'm assuming that. But when it comes to a carbonated beverage, only one should ever be served anywhere for any reason, and that is Coca-Cola. That's it. Everything else that's similar is dishwater. I'm from Morehead City, North Carolina. Pepsi was invented in New Bern, which is right up the road from us. And so almost everybody serves Pepsi where I am. It's dishwater. That's all it is. There is one right option. Look, Denise is giving me the stink eye about this, but I don't care. I'll fight Denise on this one. I don't care. It's Coke. But when it comes to salvation, there is only one option. And that's what Paul is saying in this passage. When it comes to salvation, there's only one. That Jesus is the one who saves, and there is no other option. Well, how do we put Jesus first practically speaking. So again, what I want to do this week is go through a passage at the end of it, application. What exactly do we do in order to apply the things that we talked about? How do we focus on Jesus? Well, Paul tells them in this book, we're not going to read them. I'll give you the verses, but here's what he says. First of all, know the truth about Jesus. Colossians 1:28-23. Know the truth about Jesus. Read the Bible and learn about Jesus. You say, well, what should I read? It don't matter because it's all about Him. It's all about Jesus. Read all of it. Read the truth about Jesus. Number two, live by what you learn. Colossians chapter 2 and verse 6 says, as you have received Christ, so walk in Him. He says, when you learn about Jesus, live consistently with Him. You remember back when WWJD was a big thing? I thought it was awesome. I had a bracelet myself. I had a shirt. I think it's great. I'm not criticizing it. But do you remember what WWJD stood for? What would Jesus do? You know the beauty of that is we don't have to wonder. We don't have to wonder. We know what Jesus said and we know what Jesus did. All we have to do is what? Read the Bible. And then do works consistently with Jesus. Finally, number three, Colossians chapter 3 and verse 2, have a mindset fixed on spiritual things. Set your minds above where Christ is. Because you are going to go in the direction of your focus. Many of you might know my dear friend, who's now departed, Gary Sandusky. I'm sure many of you know Gary and have heard Gary preach many times. Gary preached and was an elder at Madison, Indiana for like 50 years. I mean, he never was anywhere else, and just and he was amazing. But Gary always talks about His dad, he said, jumped on a motorcycle and drove out west and was sightseeing out west. And he said, the scenery was so beautiful. He's riding along on his motorcycle and he got so captivated by the scenery and he's looking at the scenery. Guess what happened? He drove right off the road. Broke his arm. Went to the hospital, got his arm set, propped it back up on the handlebars and took off again. But why did Gary's dad drift off the road and wreck? Because that's where he was looking. And that's where you're going to go. If you're looking at Jesus, that's the way you will go. If you're looking at the world, that's the way you'll go. Make sure that you have a spiritual mindset. Well, we're going to sing the song of invitation in just a moment so we can be ready to sing that. However we do that, if you have books or the PowerPoint or however you're going to do that, but we can be getting ready to sing that song in just a moment. I will never forget, I have been in where I preach now for 20 years. Left Versailles, Kentucky, and moved to Morehead City 20 years ago. When they called me about coming down and trying out, I had been to North Carolina, been a long time, didn't know much about North Carolina. So we're driving from Versailles down to North Carolina, down to Morehead City. And I saw a sign that I'd never seen before. And I knew immediately that North Carolina is where I needed to be. As we're driving along down the highway, there's a sign on a billboard that said, Biscuitville. Biscuitville. I thought, wait a minute. There's a whole town dedicated to biscuits and I never heard of it. You mean there's a whole town named after biscuits and I've never heard of it? North Carolina is where I belong. I had no idea. We kept driving and I kept seeing signs to Biscuitville, but that wasn't as good as it got. Guess what else they got down there? Biscuit World. That's what I'm talking about. That's amazing. A whole world dedicated to biscuits, the way it ought to be. But now let me ask you a question. If you start a restaurant and you name that restaurant Biscuitville, what had you better do well? You better make a mean biscuit. If you call that thing Biscuitville and you don't make... Now, you can make good coffee. You can make good sawmill gravy. You can make the finest bacon in the world, which is chewy, by the way, not crispy. Got to be able to put it in there and chew on it a while. You can make the best sausage. But if you call yourself Biscuitville and you don't make good biscuits, you're not going to last very long. We call ourselves the Church of what? Christ. It's, I believe, on your sign. It's on your website. It's probably on Facebook somewhere. But if we are going to call ourselves the Church of Christ, what had we better do? We had better do what Paul is trying to get the Colossians to do in the book of Colossians, and that is focus on, exalt and model ourselves after who? Not Alexander Campbell. Not Barton W. Stone. Not Colley Caldwell or Bob Owen or any of those guys. We better focus on and exalt and model ourselves after Christ. If we're going to put it on the sign, we need to do it. And that's what Paul is talking about in this letter. It might be this morning that you are not a Christian. Chances are good that if you're here this morning, you've probably been at assemblies like this. You've heard the gospel. You've heard the message about Jesus. You've heard the process of hearing and believing and repenting, confessing and being baptized and living faithfully, but you're not a Christian. You've heard it, probably a lot. You haven't done it. It's time to do it. This is the only opportunity that you will know that you have. After this moment right here, there are no guarantees. Now, the younger you are, the better you feel about things. The younger you are, you feel pretty good that there's going to be a tomorrow and a next day. And you start getting my age, you almost quit buying green bananas because you're not quite sure you're going to live to eat it when it gets ripe. Right? But the young folks are like, I got all the time in the world. You might not. You might not. Every single day, the obituaries come out and there's a young person, a teenager, a 20-something, a 30-something who will not live to see another day. Just because you're young, just because you're healthy, doesn't mean you have another day in you. This is the only moment that you know that you have. Beyond this, you're taking a big risk if you are not yet a believer. If you are a Christian and you're struggling, you might have weakness or sin or doubt, And you come to an assembly like this and you sit through it, you do the stuff and you go through it and you just keep struggling. Well, it's time to fix that, right? This is the place to get the help you need. So whatever the situation is, if you need help, we'd love to sit down with you. The preachers or some of the members or somebody here would love to sit down with you, talk to you, pray with you, study with you, baptize you. Whatever it is that you need, but we can't help you if we don't know what it is. And so this morning, if you know that you have a need and you're ready to do something about it, we'd love to help. We'd love to sit down and talk with you privately after church, or you're welcome to come forward, take a seat on the front as we stand and sing this song.